This is VOA News via remote. I'm Tommy McNeil. U.S. President Donald Trump now back at the White House after being treated for COVID-19 at Walter Reed Military Medical Center.
President Donald Trump returned to the White House Monday evening after three nights at Walter Reed National Military Medical Center, where he was treated for COVID-19. The president spoke only briefly to reporters.
How many of your staff are sick?
Thank you very much.
The White House doctor, Navy Commander Sean Conley, said Trump will not be fully out of the woods for another week, but he met or exceeded standards for discharge from the hospital. But the extent of the outbreak at the White House remains unclear. Several senior staff members have tested positive, as have several people who attended a September 26th Rose Garden ceremony where Trump announced the nomination of Amy Comey Barrett for the Supreme Court. Mike Gracia, Washington.
The head of emergencies at the World Health Organization said Monday the agency's best estimates indicate roughly 1 in 10 people worldwide may have been infected by the coronavirus. That is more than 20 times the number of confirmed cases, and it warned of a difficult period ahead. Dr. Michael Ryan, speaking to a special session of WHO's 34-member executive board focusing on COVID-19, said the figures from varying from urban to rural areas and between different groups, that it ultimately means that the vast majority of the world remains at risk. He said the pandemic would continue to evolve, but the tools exist to suppress transmission and save lives. Ryan said Southeast Asia faced a surge in cases. Europe and the Eastern Mediterranean were seeing an increase, while the situation in Africa and the Western Pacific were rather more positive. Overall, though, he said the world was heading into a difficult period. More at VOAnews.com. This is VOA News. Leaders from France, Russia, and the United States issued a joint statement Monday urging a ceasefire between Armenia and the Azerbaijan and the disputed region of Nagorno-Karabakh. Representing the co-chairs and countries of the Organization for Security and Cooperation in Europe, Minsk Group, which is tasked with finding a peaceful solution, Russia and France's foreign minister, as well as the U.S. Secretary of State, all condemned the violence, which began just more than a week ago. In a statement, the minister said the recent attacks constitute an unacceptable threat to the stability of the region. More than 40 civilians have been killed in escalating violence, with 200 more wounded and hundreds of houses seriously damaged in violence, according to the United Nations. U.S. Secretary of State Mike Pompeo on Tuesday hailed new Japanese Prime Minister Kishida Suga as force for good, and said that he believes that Suga will work to strengthen the relationship between Washington and Tokyo. Speaking at the start of his meeting with Japan's foreign minister in Tokyo, Pompeo said he agreed with Suga that a free and open Indo-Pacific region was the foundation of regional peace and stability. Suga, who replaced Shinzo Abe last month as premier, faces a tricky task, balancing the need to maintain working ties with bigger neighbor China and U.S. demands for a tougher stance. Human Rights Watch said Tuesday that hundreds of thousands of men, women, and children with mental health conditions are living chained up in roughly 60 countries. Without mental health support or awareness, families or institutions often shackle people against their will, leaving them eating, sleeping, urinating, and defecating in one small space. In the run-up to World Mental Health Day on October 10th, Human Rights Watch's report documents through almost 800 interviews how people with psychosocial disabilities in countries like China, Nigeria, and Mexico can live shackled for years, chained to trees, locked in cages, imprisoned in animal sheds. China's foreign ministry and Mexico's health ministry did not immediately respond to an email seeking comment. A Nigerian health ministry spokesman said the ministry had not seen the report and declined to comment. The organization goes on to say around the world, in state-run and private centers and traditional and religious healing institutions, handlers deny people food, force medications and herbal remedies on them, and mete out physical and sexual violence. Via remote, I'm Tommy McNeil, VOA News. We'll be right back.
Africa. Welcome to Daybreak Africa from the Voice of America. I'm James Butte in Washington. Today is Tuesday, October 6th, and here are some of the stories we are covering. Malawi President Lazarus Chakwera marks 100 days in office.
The focus of my administration in the first 100 days has been to simply turn Malawi around. For our nation has long been a flooding ship sailing in hostile waters and heading in the wrong direction.
The UN says conflict and coronavirus pandemic threaten refugee protection. Sierra Leone's former president will now appear before the Anti-Corruption Commission on Thursday this week. The Zambian opposition party Youth Wing will protest tomorrow to demand the resignation of Elections Commission chair, and South African trade unions call for a one-day strike tomorrow Wednesday.
We're just talking to the consciousness of our people and say, can you pause wherever you are and say corruption is bad, public transport is bad, gender violence is bad, and let's talk about it.
Kenyans celebrate their country's music culture from their vehicles, and Nigeria's book festival is going online this year. Those stories and more are coming up on Daybreak Africa. Malawi's President Lazarus Chakwera is asking his country to remain patient as his government tries to improve the economic situation. Chakwera spoke Monday at a news conference in the capital, Lilongwe, where he was reviewing his administration's first 100 days in office. Lamek Masina reports from Blantyre.
President Chakwera said he is aware that Malawians have a lot of expectations from his administration, such as increased employment, cheaper fertilizers, and having good schools right away. Chakwera said although he made a lot of promises before his election in June, he said that fulfilling those promises is not an easy task.
The focus of my administration in the first 100 days has been to simply turn Malawi around. For our nation has long been a flooding ship sailing in hostile waters and heading in the wrong direction. As any good sailor will tell you, stopping a flooding ship from sinking and turning it around in such hostile conditions of a pandemic are not small feats.
He said the Malawians should expect to continue sailing in the unsafe waters and worn-out vessel for a while before they see a change. However, Chakwera said despite the challenges they are facing, his administration has achieved a lot so far.
One, we have ensured public safety by gazetting new regulations to prevent the spread of COVID-19. We have engaged in discussions with more than 500 prospective investors from all over the world to make Malawi a destination for their investments. Three, we are in the process of passing a comprehensive budget that is designed to stimulate economic growth across Malawi.
Chakwera also said his government has raised the minimum wage for employees to $66 per month, a 43% increase, secured emergency funding for nearly 200 households affected by COVID-19, and increased the budget allocation for the Anti-Corruption Bureau to prosecute cases freely. However, analysts have divided opinions on Chakwera's performance. Sylvester Namiwa is executive director for the Center for Democracy and Economic Development Initiatives. He told VOA there are many areas which Chakwera failed to address in his first 100 days.
In the appointment of the cabinet, there are only three females that have made it to full cabinet ministers. This is in total violation of the Gender Equity Act. It's like they are just continuing from what the previous government stopped from, if you allow me to compare the two.
Bechani Cheleni, an economics lecturer at the University of Malawi, says he would give Chakwera a 60% rating on his early performance. He says the economic policies which President Chakwera is pursuing, especially one that sets aside 3/5% of government projects and contracts for Malawian businesses.
We are saying that the vision is about self-reliance and, of course, inclusive wealth creation. So it's a very, very courageous move that 60% of government projects and contracts are going to be given to pure Malawians. That's very great.
Sherif Kaisi, political science lecturer at Blantyre International University, hails the Chakwera's administration for its commitment in the fight against corruption. But Kaisi says the crackdown should also be extended to those serving in the current administration and others, not just on those who served under former President Peter Mutharika, as is the case now. Lamek Masina for VOA News, Blanta.
South African trade unions have called for a national stay-away strike tomorrow, Wednesday. Congress of South African Trade Unions, COSATU General Secretary Becky Shalin-Shale, says the strike will highlight issues such as unemployment, corruption, gender-based violence, and the erosion of collective bargaining. He says workers need to speak out against public and private sector corruption because the estimated 27 billion rands lost to corruption could have created 27,000 jobs.
The purpose of our action on Wednesday first is about the contribution to the Global Day of Decent Work that is internationally celebrated on the 7th of October. But our focus this time is about six issues. The first one is about the transport, that any economy that has to thrive has to have a proper transport. In our case, the public transport is in a mess. The second point we are making is about corruption in our country, that it has gone to a very bad situation, that the money that the society pays is being looted by few elite. And we think as a society, we need to stand firm against corruption. The third point that we are raising, of course, is about the question of unemployment, and that we just in this 5 months now in the COVID, we have lost about 2.2 million jobs. And the fourth one, which is related to the gender-based violence, that in our country, we have seen unprecedented violence against women and children. People are being killed. And we are calling a conscience of our people, because it is not only the law enforcement that can deal with these issues. It's the society as a whole.
How much impact does corruption have on labor?
It's huge, because corruption destroys jobs in our view. We just construct and say, if so many billions that is supposed to be given back to the economy to create jobs and then goes to people who are doing corruption, it's huge. I mean, we try to quantify about how many jobs corruption would do. Then we said 27 billion rands lost in corruption could have created about 70,000 jobs. So workers start to understand that corruption kill jobs, corruption kill the industry, corruption kill service delivery. So it's an issue that every worker says we must stop corruption, both in the public and in the private sectors, because the corruption in the public sector will not happen unless there's a counterpart in the private sectors who says to the officials and to the public servants, do this thing in this way.
As you know, COVID-19 has wreaked havoc on not only South Africa, but the entire world. Are you allowed to go on strike during this time?
We're allowed to go on strike. The strike is in our constitution. The question of the Disaster Management Act does not prevent strike. Of course, we take upon ourselves that whenever we go out on action, we need to obey the question of social distancing, the question of masks, the question of sanitization, not because somebody tells us to do so, because it's our own consciousness that we need to prevent the spread of the virus.
Thank you so much for taking the time to speak with us. We appreciate very much.
Thank you very much.
Becky Shalin-Shale is General Secretary of the Congress of South African Trade Unions, COSATU. He was speaking with us from Johannesburg. The youth wing of the opposition National Democratic Congress, NDC Party of Zambia, has scheduled a protest this Wednesday, October 7, to demand the resignation of Electoral Commission Chairperson Justice Issa Chulu. The group is also calling for the resignation of two other Electoral Commission officials. This after accusing them of planning to rig next year's elections in favor of incumbent President Edgard Lungu and his governing Patriotic Front Party. Electoral Commission officials say the accusations are without merit. National NDC Youth Chairperson Charles Kabuita spoke with VOA's Peter Clotty about tomorrow's protest.
The Electoral Commission of Zambia have not called the stakeholders, in this case the opposition, the civil society, and the church, to actually explain why they are conducting online voter registration. We have nothing against the undertaking, but we feel the process is suspicious. So this is why, as opposition political party, we feel that the election may be rigged in 2021, and this could just be a step into what I may call the beginning of rigging the 2021 elections.
The Electoral Commission is the only constitutionally mandated institution in Zambia in charge of organizing or administering elections. So whatever it will do to organize is what the Constitution grants it the power to do. If because of COVID, for which they are conducting this process as part of organizing the elections, why are you suspicious of it?
We are suspicious because COVID is now being used in Zambia to deter the opposition from organizing itself and meeting its members. The ruling Patriotic Front here in Zambia are having meetings almost on a daily basis. The Electoral Commission of Zambia cannot use an excuse of COVID-19 because it's business as usual in Zambia. People are meeting, and for as long as you are wearing a face mask, you can have it your way. And what we are suspicious of as opposition is the fact that the Electoral Commission of Zambia also wants to do away with the old register. And their intention is to capture about 9 million people, which we are saying it's practically impossible. 9 million people cannot be captured in a space of 30 days.
Are you therefore saying the Electoral Commission does not have the ability to compile a new voter register within 30 days if it's able to educate Zambians about the need to register to vote? Why are you doubtful about this? It is possible, isn't it?
They have the ability, but the method that they are using and the period they've given themselves to capture the 9 million people is also suspicious. We feel that they want to reduce the number of people who will go to vote and play around the figures, since the figure will be so small, in order to rig the election on behalf of the Patriotic Front. The issue is under the current leadership of Mr. Esau Chulu, Patrick Nshindano, and Madam Emily Sikazwa is being talked about by the people of Zambia. We do not trust the trio, and we feel that if these cities are left unchecked, they will put this country on fire. Because elections are very sensitive in our country. I don't know about where you are, but in our country, they are very sensitive because this is the only time people are given an opportunity to elect new leaders who can bring hope for Zambia.
Charles Kabuita is the National Youth Chairperson of Opposition National Democratic Congress Party of Zambia. He was speaking with VOA's Peter Clotty from the capital, Lusaka. You are listening to Daybreak Africa on The Voice of America. I'm James Butte in Washington. Today is Tuesday, October 6th. In Sierra Leone, former President Ernest Bai Koroma's appearance before the country's Anti-Corruption Commission has been moved from yesterday, October 5th, to this Thursday, October 8th. The commission wants to question the two-term former president about alleged corruption while he was in office. A corruption inquiry report released last month ordered Mr. Koroma and some of his former officials to forfeit assets totaling $200 million. They have also been barred from leaving the country. Mr. Koroma says the allegations are politically motivated and intended to question his reputation. Patrick Sandy, the spokesperson for the Anti-Corruption Commission, says the former president and his lawyers requested to move the date to Thursday.
He did not come to the commission for the interview as it had been planned or as it were in the summons served on him, for the simple reason that yesterday his lawyers wrote to the commissioner asking for an extension or a shift in the time to Thursday, because in the summons we outlined the many issues that we'll be talking to regarding. So they said that they are wide-ranging, and by the way, there are 18 issues, and as such, they are complex, and it could have taken time as when they happened. So they wanted him to prepare sufficiently, so let us give him time, which the commissioner agreed. So we are now expecting the interview to go on Thursday, which will be the 8th of October.
When the hearing finally takes place, in what form is it going to take place? In a courtroom type situation where the former president is going to be questioned, like a judge questioning him?
No, this is an investigation. So the form it will have to take would be, you would have an interviewer, and I'm sure you would have somebody assisting the interviewer. And somebody also will be there to assist. in terms of handling documents, as it will just be determined by the investigating team. But you'll have people on the side of investigations, let me put it that way, or the interviewer side, and then you'll have him as the interviewee who they will be putting questions to, and then you'll have his legal representation. So it will be, call it like in an interview room. It could be in an open place, it could be like in a hall, but then they sit, of course, at a point where they will be distant, and they will be talking and somebody hearing. As I've seen somebody ask questions, you have a recorder of those questions, and it has to be contemporaneous because that's how normally investigations do happen in the aspect of interview statements recording.
You know, there are those who continue to say that by going after the former president and even his former officials, this may discourage other Sierra Leoneans or anyone else who wants to take a position in the government, or may even make it harder for, say, former presidents to want to leave office peacefully.
I will disagree with them, because one thing we should understand is the commission is not interviewing the former president because he was former president, but rather there are corruption-related issues which he should provide answers to. Somebody would have that view, but from our own perspective, from the anti-corruption point of view, what we have been saying to the public and what we stand to protect and what we stand to do is to go after the evidence, no matter who or what is involved. As an institution, we are accountable to the people of this country, and as such, if we are doing our work, we should do it dispassionately and diligently.
Patrick, thank you so much.
Thank you, James.
Patrick Sandy is the spokesperson for the Sierra Leone Anti-Corruption Commission. He was speaking with us from the capital, Freetown. UN High Commissioner for Refugees, Filippo Grandi, says the coronavirus pandemic poses unparalleled challenges and threats to refugee protection at a time when conflicts are flaring up in many parts of the world. The High Commissioner was speaking at the opening of the agency's annual executive committee meeting in Geneva. Lisa Schlein has more for VOA.
The conference is opening in the midst of a pandemic that has infected more than 35 million people and killed more than 1 million. UNHCR Chief Filippo Grandi says so far major outbreaks in large refugee settings have been prevented, but he notes the risk of contagion is huge. He says everyone must remain vigilant, especially as the pandemic has not stopped wars, pushing the number of forcibly displaced to nearly 80 million. He says the Central Sahel region in Africa is one of the most worrying political and humanitarian crises in the world, but notes there are many others. He cites new conflict-driven displacements in hot spots such as Mozambique, the recent clashes between Armenia and Azerbaijan, violence and human rights abuses in Nicaragua, and the situation in Yemen, where the fear of famine now looms large amidst the spread of COVID-19.
Governments around the world have taken tough measures to stop the spread of the coronavirus, often closing borders. Obviously, some restrictions are needed, but stopping the virus and offering protection must not be a zero-sum equation. Both are possible, and lives can be saved.
Grandi says more than 110 states have found ways to make asylum systems work while taking necessary health precautions. He says the UNHCR has helped countries protect refugees when large influxes occur. For example, he says Uganda, which hosts more than 1.4 million refugees, reopened its borders to allow entry to 3,000 people fleeing deadly armed conflict in DR Congo. He acknowledges the difficulties facing countries, but says closing the door to people fleeing war and persecution is not a solution.
People will continue to flee unless the root causes of their flight are solved. Reducing search and rescue capacity, or impeding those who engage to save others, or pushing back people without due process will not stop people from moving. It will only lead to more deaths and the further erosion of refugee protection.
High Commissioner Grandi says the global uncertainty posed by COVID-19 should not deter nations from seeking solutions to forced displacement. On the contrary, he says the pandemic should spur them on to help the most vulnerable in this time of greatest need. He says most refugees prefer to return home, but some simply cannot and will not. While they await solutions, he says refugees must be provided with educational, job, and other opportunities to make the most of their potential in countries of asylum. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
Kenya hosted over the weekend its first social distance culture and music event where people enjoyed live bands while they could sit in their vehicles to avoid spreading COVID-19. The Kikwitu Festival aims to bring Kenyans together despite the pandemic to celebrate the country's cultural diversity. Mohammed Yusuf reports from Nairobi.
Hundreds of Kenyans drove to Carnival Grounds in central Nairobi to attend the first drive-in cultural and music festival. The two-day event brought together music lovers and those who love to bond while in their cars. Nina Ogot is a Kenyan musician and one of the performers. She says the drive-in is a new experience for her and the attendees.
It's a new normal, let me say, and it takes a little getting used to. You can see the audience is also like trying to find their way, how to respond to the music, because dancing is a bit, they can't come to the stage. And even for the artist, you talk to the space, you talk to the cars, and you hope people are in the car listening. So it's a bit cold, it feels.
The festival was held just a few days after Kenya eased COVID restrictions. No more than four people could be in each vehicle, and people were advised to keep a physical distance to limit the coronavirus spread. Dan Odhiambo, the founder of the Kikwetu Festival, said people must adapt to the new life under COVID-19.
We are in this for the long haul. COVID is still around, and we have to keep safe. We have to observe the rules. We have to social distance, so we don't have a choice but to look for ways of making sure that our people can consume our products like music or events in a safe way.
Amida Mudoni is one of hundreds who attended the event. She says she's happy to be out.
This is the first public event I've been, and for sure we really miss this kind of event.
Festival goer Kiche Omondi agrees.
It's a beautiful evening, and I think all the Ministry of Health protocols have been kept, and it's good that we are able to be out and we are having fun one more time.
Oscar said he's enjoying the outdoor event and music after months at home.
The first time after 7 months that there is an event like this. I love it. And it's a beautiful day, beautiful weather. It couldn't be better. Excellent music. What more do you want?
The event went into the night, but it wasn't long before the enjoyment was cut short by the nighttime curfew. A reminder, Kenya continues to record COVID-19 cases. The East African nation has recorded more than 39,000 cases and 731 people have died. Mohammed Yusuf for VOA News, Nairobi.
And that's it for this Tuesday, October 6th edition of Daybreak Africa. On behalf of the Daybreak Africa team, producer Nicole Beckford, reporters Peter Colotti and Ricky Stryak, as well as sports editor Samson O'Malley, along with all of our engineers, I'm James Barton in Washington, wishing you a very good day.
Hello, I'm Douglas Simpoga, host of VOA's Reporters Roundtable. Join us every Thursday as we discuss important African topics and events. I'll have a panel of African journalists and expert guests to discuss the topic at hand. We take a deeper look at important African news topics. That's Reporters Roundtable every Thursday at 17:30 UTC, right here on VOA Africa.
Sports fans, brighten your day by tuning into the sunny side of sports Monday through Friday at 16:30 and 18:30 UTC. Join us on Facebook at facebook.com/VOA Sunny and on Twitter at VOA Sunny Sports. Or check out the blog at blogs.voanews.com/sunny. It's the sunny side of sports right here on the Voice of America.